Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Formosa Plastics versus Presidio Engineers.
May it please the Court, Mr. Michael Haschel will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. This is a simple contract dispute over a combination of disagreements and an arm's length contract. A dispute over delay damages and extra expense on a construction site. However, it was tried as a court action. Judgment was taken, and the Court of Appeals indeed so found it was taken, on breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing and fraud. The actual damages incurred were contract damages. In argument to the jury, counsel said that the damages for fraud, good faith and fair dealing, and contract are exactly the same. Nevertheless, punitive damages were submitted in an amount of $10 million for what was ultimately a net dispute between the parties of $250,000 was assessed, awarded, and that's why we're here today. I will discuss two issues with the court. First is breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. I will contend that it was not a submissive theory. I will then discuss fraud and will contend that fraud was not properly submitted because there's no independent fraud injury. And second, there is no evidence of fraud in any event.
Ms. Hexel, if you don't mind, let me ask you a question before you get into that. Based upon your opening comments, you say that this is the case involving only contract damages. What is the explanation for the fact that, if I recall, there was a jury finding four contract damages, separate jury finding four damages, and those numbers are not the same?
First of all, Your Honor, in argument to the jury, as I said, counsel stated that the damages were the same. I don't know that you can necessarily, see in our transport company versus county, use the answer to the contract issue to make a tort finding out of the fraud damages, but it's a fairly lengthy explanation for that. What they have contended in this case is because of the fraud, we are not bound by the contract, and therefore, what we will do is we will base our fraud damages on what we would have been if we know the so-called fraud. So what they did in that case simply was said, I would have bid $1.3 million, I was paid $600,000, and you subtract the two and the $700,000. It's still the contract measure. What I was bid on the contract, what I got, and the difference is due to breach of the contract for failure to pay. So they're exactly the same. The jury simply picked the numbers from the testimony of the various witnesses, but they are exactly the same. Contract, the damage, $700,000 is based on contract value, $467,000 is based on the same. We not allege that there's a conflict between the two, they have neither.
Is it your position they can never be the same?
In this case,
can never.
As the issues were framed and submitted, they always have to be the same in this case. The breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing has never been recognized in Texas between two arm's length contracting parties at a construction site. Owner, contractor, contractor, subcontractor is not the type of relationship that either qualifies as a formal fiduciary relationship, qualifies as a special relationship, and in this case, it does not qualify as a so-called confidential relationship based upon prior dealings between the parties that make trust inherent. These two parties did not know each other before the contract in question. They never had any long-standing relationship standing apart from the contract that justified a factual submission of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. I will not spend much more time on this because, candidly, even after having obtained a judgment on the basis of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, argued to the jury to get $10 million in punitive damages on the basis of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, Presidio has never defended the submission of that. And I submit to the
jury. Well, don't they say we can get it on fraud anyway?
That's right,
because
Your Honor,
the way the case is submitted.
They say that, Your Honor. They say that you are disempowered from considering the impact of that error in this case.
Well, why can't the court just disregard that they finally render a judgment based upon the independent fraud claim?
Can't do that, Your Honor, because essentially the cow is out of the barn. They have plied the jury with this. The breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing relates to conduct of a different nature that occurred at a different time, and the taint has already occurred. You cannot believe it ex post facto.
Is that an evidence problem, or is that a matter of the court's power in fashioning a judgment?
No, in this case, it's not me, it's neither. It is simply the question of a taint of error. This court dealt with this problem in Wingate versus Hadley. There you had two submissions, two theories of recovery. Actual and punitive damages were based upon both indiscriminately. That's the problem, Your Honor. It's the indiscriminate basis upon which the damages were awarded. There's only one award of punitive damages in this case that has collapsed on both theories. What the trial court may do afterwards, after the taint, after it has produced the damages, is inconsequential. Let me give Your Honor an example from your own case in Morgell, where you say that punitive damages arises from criminal law. If we had had an indictment in this case that said, you are hereby indicted because you have stolen a car in the amount of $10,000 from Joe Smith, or you coveted his car, you certainly wouldn't say that you would quash that indictment, because later on the court would say, well, you know, coveting a car is not a crime. So clearly, if this court did anything, Wingate versus Hackett, it meant that the taint from the improper submission, which led to a single punitive damages award, must result in a reversal in this case. Regretfully, it only results, as I understand Mr. Justice Heck's opinion in Spencer versus Eaton Stalker, in a reversal and remand. We are asking the court to reverse and render judgment for us in this case because the fraud submission is equally tainted as well and should not have been submitted.
So in the future, do you think that the way charges should be submitted to the jury would be for each different cause of action that could be arises in a given event? Each of those causes of action should have their own separate line for punitive damages.
The thing I think first, Your Honor, is that in any case in which punitive damages are submitted, you ought to make very sure that they're submitted on theories upon which punitive damages are properly awarded. The use of separate answer blanks can be a useful tool. I mean, if Your Honor, look at the Rawson-Tarina case cited in our opposing counsel's brief, you will see the utility of separate answer blanks, which in that instance saved the judgment. So, number one, I say the simple solution is to submit it correctly. Number two, if answer blanks, separate answer blanks can be used, we guess they should be recorded.
If that's the case, carrying this out to its further extension, if you have a fraud cause of action and a bad faith cause of action, and you have different numbers for actual damages for each, different numbers for punitive damages for each, would the plan be entitled to recover both punitive damages?
You would not do that. As I understand virtually, Your Honor, there is an implicit election that is made which causes the judgment to stand upon a single theory. And that would be the maximum amount recoverable in that instance related to one theory. In that way, then, you can apply the Krauss factors against both the underlying conduct and the award punitive damages. If a reversal is justified, then you would fall back to the alternative theory and apply the Krauss factors there as well.
Would you articulate why you think you're entitled to a rendition rather than a remand under your theory?
We are not entitled to a rendition, Your Honor, if the court were to reverse only on the basis of good faith and fair dealing. We are entitled to a rendition, if I can also show you, and I'm going to do so now, a fatal flaw in the fraud submission. The reason that the fraud submission is improper in this case is easily demonstrated by litmus tests, which this court has promulgated in its most recent opinions. There are three litmus tests that I can identify And I'm going to add a fourth for the court that I think is very helpful today. First of those is to look at the source of the duty. In this case, the duty to pay for delay damages and extra expense comes from the contract itself. The second that Mistass Court has used is what is the nature of the injury. And the nature of the injury in this case is the failure to pay for sums due under the contract. The third litmus test comes from the Morial decision, which measures the qualitative difference between the injury sustained and what's claimed as damages. In this case, there is no qualitative difference because what's claimed as damages is pure breach of contract. Sums due under the contract that would be equally cognizable for breach of contract. Let me add a fourth consideration that I think is very useful in analyzing this case. That consideration is, what is the core conduct by which Presidio seeks to mature its claim? And what is the conduct that makes Formosa liable in this case? The core conduct to mature the claim is Presidio's performance of the contract. And the core conduct that makes Formosa liable is its failure to pay for that performance measured by the standards of the contract.
Under what scenario could you have a contract?
There would be two, Your Honor, in what I would consider to be true fraud cases. Historically, fraud developed really more as out of the reliance aspect. So if for some reason you are fraudulently induced into a contract and you make certain preparations and expenditures to meet that contract, you discover the fraud and you do not stand for the bargain, then certainly you can recover those kinds of damages, which would be independent of the core nature of the contract and fraud. The other would be where you stand for the bargain and you prove what some people call consequential damages, and I sometimes call special damages. Let's say that the performance of the contract has collaterally caused you to lose other business or other valuable contracts, or even to, it has destroyed a corporate or a partnership. Those would be the kinds of things that would be independent. I think if Your Honor would look at the Airborne case, which Judge Larson, in applying the economic law source of the injury rule to reverse a fraud judgment, identifies the various types of damages that could have been separate and independent fraud and tort damages, but they simply weren't proved.
So that if, in this case, there had been an express representation in the contract by the owner that other contractors will not get in your way and you will be able to go about your work with as much dispatch as you're capable of. And the owner knew when he made that representation in the contract that it was false. In fact, he intended quite the opposite, but he made that representation squarely in the contract to induce execution and intended for the contractor to rely. Would that be a problem?
Yeah.
So there is no such thing as fraud in the inducement?
Oh, no.
Of the contract?
No, absolutely not. There is fraud in the inducement. We're not taking any other position. What we are taking the position is relying upon at least six cases, including some from this court, that the source of the duty and the nature of the injury rule is applied in fraud in the inducement cases. And what you have to do is you have to do as you have done in all of these cases. Nature of the injury, source of the duty, and the qualitative nature of the injury. Fraud is a tort, like any of the other torts. And all we're saying is that you apply the same rule that you've always applied.
If I did not want to stand to the bargain in that case, I wanted out, would my relief be through fraud by rescission, or would it be through a contract theory?
You do either one, I think, but if you want out of the bargain, you certainly do have the right, when you know of the fraud, to terminate the contract at that point. He could have walked off his job and he would have been entitled to his Rely damages under a fraud theory up to that point. And let me make a very important point in answering your question, Your Honor, as to why the fraud in this case could also not be the product, I mean, why the damages in this case are not the product of fraud. The so-called misrepresentation, particularly concerning concrete and delay and interference, were known by this contractor in September of the contract year. And he performed the contract September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, and May. So I would say to the court that it's very difficult for me to understand how the damages which were proved during that period and were not damages before you knew of the fraud were in any way either induced by or the product of fraud. Our prayer, therefore, is that the court reverse the judgments below and render judgment on the contract.
Any other questions?
One more question, Mr.
Sure. Chairman.
You say that at most this is a contract your client intended to perform, but for which the other side should have sued you only for a breach of contract. They say your client never intended to perform the contract, and this is fraud and inducement of the contract in the first instance.
Your Honor, that is a slight overstatement of their contentions, but they do have now an argument. They've never, it's an argument they've had anyway before. What they say now is that there was promissory fraud in that aspect of the contract which said that we would pay for delay damages within our control. And that's the only place promissory fraud is existing. And
I'd be more than happy. I'm sorry, I appreciate the distinction you're making. I didn't mean to miss a mistake.
But it is very important in this case, Your Honor, because this is an argument that they have never made before.
My question, though, is relates to damages. Why would the damages be necessarily different if a party breaches a contract and, on the other hand, in an alternative scenario, never intends to perform the contract in the first instance and therefore is guilty of fraud? Why are the damages necessarily different, and why is that such a problem in this case?
Your Honor, I think in the fully performed contract where a party stands to the bargain after knowledge of fraud, it is going to be very, very difficult to ever find a fraud theory that is not really a contract theory masquerading as fraud. Only in the instance, I believe, in which I answered to just a moment ago, would there be a separate and distinct fraud damages. To me, in the fully performed contract, after knowledge of the purported fraud, it is very, very difficult to demonstrate that there is a distinction when all you are seeking is the recovery of damages that would be due under the contract. Now, if, for example, I fraudulently supplied plans and specifications on this job and they resulted in a collapse that crushed the contractor's truck, of course they're going to be different. But all that's sought in this case are delay damages and extra expense, which the parties have allocated the risk for in the latter portions of the contract.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. William Powers will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. Before I begin, I'd like to just correct one aspect of the record. We did not know about this fraud until the litigation began and was discovered. The most we knew before this litigation began was that things were not as the contract said they would be when we got on the site. But we did not know it was fraud. We did not know we had a claim for fraud. It's simply not true that we knew it was a fraud and somehow waived it again and kept going. I was happy when I received Formosa's new brief yesterday to learn that they no longer are arguing that the economic loss will apply across the board and so on. So that the question in this case is really no evidence question. That is there evidence of fraud in this case? And there is ample evidence of fraud. Fraud in the inducement.
Now, what about his argument of that when you look at the record, the damages are the same for every asserted theory of recovery, no difference.
The damages are not the same for every asserted theory of recovery. As Justice Abbott pointed out, the jury came in with separate damages for fraud and separate damages for contract, and that's not because the jury got confused. The damages were separate, Your Honor, because the fraud claim was submitted underlying Decker under a fraud theory of damages, which is the value of what we gave up in comparison to the value of what we got in return.
Well, that's the argument that if we'd have known what was the right facts at the first, we would have bid $1.3 million instead of $600,000.
That's
that
correct.
Right?
And the measure of damages, therefore, is measured by the fact that we were induced under a scheme that Formosa had premeditated with. We were induced to come in with a low bid. That was their scheme. If we had not been induced to come in with a low bid, we would have bid higher and we would have received more for the work we performed. So the damages here are not just not getting the contract damages for delay. The damages here are caused by the fact that we bid this under false pretenses, that they knew were false when they induced us into the contract. That is simply a different measure of damages. It is the reliance measure of damages. By the way, the contract claim was submitted under the benefit of the bargain measure of damages. So the damages here were clearly separate. It is simply false that we were simply getting delay damages under the contract. We're getting traditional fraud damages because we refused to come in with a low bid. They have tried to paint this case from the beginning as simply nothing more than a breach of contract. That's what they're doing again today. According to Formosa, all that happened was that there were delays, as they say, as often in the case of construction contracts. Then there was a dispute, and a dispute about delay damages. Nothing more than that. In fact, when Rip was granted the Supreme Court Journal, described the case in almost those identical terms. But that's just not what happened here. That's not what the evidence showed. We didn't just have a dispute after the contract was formed. They had a scheme to intentionally mislead us and other contractors before the contract into coming in, as I was mentioning, with low bids. They did it by intentionally lying and withholding information, about who controlled the concrete, about access to the job site, and about the schedule. They never intended to pay the delay damages. That's all in the record. And they stood to gain millions and millions of dollars by getting the contractors to come in.
Well, whether they intend to pay delay damages or not, did the jury award delay damages in this case?
The jury awarded delay damages under our contract claim,
so
not under our fraud.
So if you execute on the judgment, the delay damages will get paid.
If we execute on the judgment under the fraud claim, your delay damages won't get paid.
But I guess my point is, what difference does it make that they entered into a contract that they didn't intend to comply with if the contract is binding on them and you sue them and you collect under the contract by judgment?
Well, if that were the case, Your Honor, anybody could engage in fraud, intentionally lie. When they got caught, they said, now we'll pay our contract. That would simply write the law of fraud out of Texas law. That would be a safe harbor in any fraud case. Oh, we're sorry. We'll go ahead and pay the contract damage. Now, they didn't intend even to do that when they entered the contract. They get caught, and they come out and pay the contract damage. By the way, that was their scheme. Induce low bids, hassle the contractors on the delay damages, and the worst that will happen, they'll save money on the low bids, but the worst that will happen, they claim they'll have to pay delay damage.
But under your theory of this case, if they just screwed up, they were just incompetent. They didn't really know how long it would take. They didn't misrepresent it. They just goofed. And it wasn't that they lied about the control of the job or the availability of materials. They just, it was just a comedy of errors. Then they would only be entitled to recover contract damages. But if they think about it ahead of time, that's what makes the difference.
That's correct. That is the crucial difference between breach of contract and fraud. If you know about it and lie in advance and never intend to complete the contract, that's fraud. And that's exactly what happened in Spoljarin. In Spoljarin, the only damage that the plaintiff who was promised the bonus suffered was he didn't get the bonus. And it was still fraud. Because before the contract was entered into, the finding was that the defendant never intended to pay the damages. It was just failed to get the bonus that was promised. common, and yet the court still said it was fraud and punitive damages.
So rather than Mr. Hatchell's litmus test, your litmus test is not with respect to the kinds of damages or the nature of the injury. Those could all overlap and, in fact, be identical. The issue is, was there an evil purpose that was motivating this for which the law imposes punishment?
That's our position, my position, and it's been the law's position in Texas for 150 years. That is exactly the difference between fraud and breach of contract. I'd like to make another brief comment about Spilgjari. There was a serious problem with Spilgjari, and that is that the jury was permitted to infer the intent never to comply, the fraudulent intent, from the mere breach after the fact. Now, the majority opinion of Spilgjari said, well, it was a good inference, but virtually, there was an inference of fraud simply from the breach. And we're not arguing for that. I am very sympathetic to the dissenting opinion in Spilgjari on whether there was some evidence of intent to defraud. But the evidence in our case is overwhelming. And I'd like to just mention some of it. Not
Mr. Harris, so your contention is that the petitioners have a complaint that a breach of contract lawsuit can be transmogrified into a fraud case. You're saying that's true and it's always been the case.
It can't be transmogrified. They cannot commit fraud. This isn't a situation where they did something that after the fact the jury comes back and says, oh, good faith and fair dealing, reasonableness, we don't think you behaved quite right. They know when they're lying. And the evidence shows they know that they're lying. So
I guess my question should be a little bit more refined, and that is, you're saying when there's evidence that they never intended to perform in the first instance,
even though
they signed the contract.
That's correct. That's fraud. It's always been fraud. And even if the damage, it is our position, well, Jarrett's position, it goes back to Graham versus Roeder, I think 4 years after Stager, the only damages in Graham versus Roeder was that there, that the promise was not performed, but because there was no intent to perform the promise before the contract was entered into, it was fraud and inducement, that made it a fraud case and there were punitive damages. So this distinction about the kind of damages applying to fraud has never been in the law of Texas. It's not in the restatement. It's not in the law of any jurisdiction. Now, in this case, Your Honor, the court really doesn't need to even reach that issue because, as my answer to Justice Baker a moment ago, there were separate damages here. There was a separate instruction on damages for fraud, which was the out-of-pocket instruction, the difference between what is given and what is received. What was received by us was low because we're induced by fraudulent behavior to make a low bid. That was a different measure of damages than the jury was instructed on in the contract measure of damages, that was the benefit of the bargain measure of damages. So the problem that you're raising, Your Honor, about whether the damages can or must be different, the answer to that is they don't have to be different. There's never been the law of fraud to make them that says they have to be different. But the court doesn't really need to reach here. There were different damages. It is simply wrong that they say the damages here.
Well, why isn't the underlying injury the same? Even if you assess them differently, you're not awarding different amounts for different things. You're still looking at the additional cost to perform and the profit that you would or should have made for performing that work. Isn't that the same under both theories?
Well, the damage is not being paid. It's not that being paid for what we promised to do in the sense of delay. We gave something up. That is, we gave up something valuable for us that we had. That is, we made a promise we'd do this work, and we got something in return. And what we got in return was the amount of money on the bid. And we were induced to come in with a low bid. So what we got in return was fraudulently induced. It's like I sell an automobile to somebody, and I claim it's a Mercedes, and it's not. If it's not a Mercedes, and I know it's not a Mercedes, I'm defrauding. Or if I take a car from them, and they think it's an ordinary car, but I happen to know it's a rare car, and it's under a situation where I have to dispose of it, I'm defrauding them out of something that they have that's valuable. The fraud here is that they induced us to come in and make low bids, and not just us, but every other contractor on this job.
You started to summarize the evidence of fraud.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And this is just a bit of the evidence. The bid package in Plaintiff's Exhibit 2 had specific statements that the contractors would control the concrete. That is a crucial thing on one of these construction jobs. The bid package said that. It wasn't true for enough, for most of them at the time.
What's the evidence of the damage caused by the
Mr. Burnett, who's the president of Presidio, said that affected his bid. It induced him to make a low bid, which is exactly the damages that we're
granting.
Oh, because if you can't schedule control, if you have to depend on someone else, then it just makes the job much harder to engage in. You have to go through more steps. You have to hassle with people. It just makes it a construction job much, much more
difficult. What evidence was there because
Mr. Burnett testified specifically that if he had known that he was not going to get control of the concrete, and that's not the only issue, but the package of volume statement, if he had known otherwise, he would have made a different bid. So the damage difference is the difference between the bid we actually made and the bid we wouldn't have.
What is the evidence that Formosa knew that they it would be different from what the bid package did?
Mr. Lynch, who is the head of the civil department at Formosa, was asked about the bid package, and he specifically stated that it was deceptive. Specifically stated it was deceptive. Stated that they knew it wasn't true and the contractors wouldn't know that information.
Where is that?
That's at page, volume 12, page 112A and 112B of the record. He was, let me just read from it for a moment. This is on, I'm sorry, 112A and 113A in volume 12. The question to Mr. Lynn. Okay, so don't you think that it's a little deceptive to send out a bid package to contractors saying, look, you're going to be responsible for and in control of delivery and scheduling of the concrete, when in fact you know that they're not going to be? Doesn't that seem deceptive to you? Mr. Lynn's answer was, yes.
And all
that's evidence of fraud right there. And there's more. Other Formosa witnesses testified of different aspects. This would be deceptive and fraudulent.
To the extent there are differences between what was stated in the bid package and what was stated in the contract, and the contract was closer to the truth, does that vitiate any misrepresentations or non-disclosures in the bid package?
Well,
for example, the argument is made that we didn't know we were not going to get access to the job whenever we wanted it, but the contract has language in it that says you're going to have to deal with all these other people on the job.
Well, it does have language about coordinating with other people, but the impression given in the bid package, and by the way, Mr. Marin, Camp Marin testifies on the scheduling specifically, that everybody knows you're going to have to deal with other people. The question is, what's the schedule? Are you going to be on top of other people when you're out there on the job site? They had a master schedule. It's in the evidence. They had a master schedule that they knew was contrary to what they had said in the bid package.
My question is there, if there's a statement in the bid package and a different statement in the contract, does the latter initiate the fraudulent effect of the former?
Well, if somebody makes a misrepresentation and corrects it in some way, in fact, our duty to disclose is based on that they have an obligation to correct some of these mistakes. If somebody actually corrects it before the contract is signed. You know, I say it's a Mercedes, and then before you sign the contract, I say, well, it's really not. We wouldn't say there's fraud in those circumstances, but it's just not the case that the contract vitiates all of the misrepresentations that were made prior to the inducement to enter the contract.
Suppose the contract says, suppose the bid says these are the circumstances that exist. The contract comes in and says that if those circumstances don't exist, we will obligate ourselves to pay X amount of dollars. Would that vitiate fraud where there was no intent to have those circumstances exist?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't. People assign risk in contract all the time. Maybe there's oil on the land, maybe there's not. It's one thing to assign the risk of something happening. Maybe the party's supposed to put it. They'll have a schedule of damages provision. If this doesn't come true, we'll compensate you in a certain way. It's one thing to assign risk. It's another when it's a certainty. It's like the difference between insurance and having to be a certainty. Risk and knowing something's going to happen are different. We wouldn't have agreed to the schedule of damages if we'd known not that there was a risk of damage like there is in a construction contract, but in fact, the damages were certain. I'm sorry, the delays were certain and planned. That's not assigning a risk in a contract. That's letting somebody get away with fraud.
Didn't your party... The argument here is that there was liability for delays and the jury awarded. So didn't your party assign the risk that they didn't know whether there'd be delays to Formosa? In other words, you say Formosa defrauded us because Formosa knew there would be delays. Things just weren't true. Didn't you in the contract foresee that by assigning to Formosa the financial obligation to cover those risks?
Well, they were going to cover them according to a formula, but there's other damage. The damage we're suing under isn't just the delay damage. That's what Mr. Hatchell keeps saying. It's just the delay damage. We're suing because we came in with a low bid. That we would have come in with a higher bid if we'd known the truth.
Well, makes you feel so certain that if you had come in with a higher bid, you would have obtained the contract?
It doesn't depend on us obtaining the contract. It's like saying that if I'd known it was a Mercedes, I might not have, and had to pay more, I might not have gotten it. Nevertheless, I still did give up something valuable of mine in return for their promise based on the low bid. Those are the facts that they actually were. By the way, it's also the case that if they'd been truthful to every contract, we still might have a low bid. But our argument is not dependent upon us getting the bid at the higher price. The bid at the higher price was the difference between what we would have bid had we known the truth and what we bid given their offer. That's the proper measure of fraud damages, whether we would have done it at the higher bid or not.
Let me ask you a question about the narrative damages.
Yes.
Let's assume for right now that that there is no duty of good faith and fair dealing in that situation. How are we to feel certain that the jury awarded that amount of narrative damages for the conduct which was fraud as opposed to breaching a duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the punitive damages are awarded not against an underlying theory. They're awarded for bad conduct. All of the evidence of their bad conduct under either theory would have been relevant to punitive damages. But the only solution to it, and Mr. Hatchell seemed to agree, this is what he's arguing for, is to have separate punitive damage findings for each of the underlying theories. Because if we don't have that, we're going to be going back and forth between the appellate courts and the trial courts all the time. Be a terrible waste of judicial economy. If you're going to reverse because there was a combined punitive damage, the only solution to that is to have separate punitive damage money.
Well, are you arguing that that's it was your burden to submit separate? So are you conceding reversible error?
No, we're not conceding reversible error. If you reverse on this, in every single product liability case, with a design claim, a failure to warn claim, a negligence claim, a breach of warranty claim, every single product liability plaintiff, if you follow what Mr. Hatchell was suggesting, will come in and ask the trial court, because you would be telling the trial court this was proper, we want a separate punitive damage finding. We want 3, 4, 5 bites at the apple on punitive damages for each of the underlying substantive claims, underlying compensatory claims. That's going to be a nightmare. No, but it could go up on appeal and we could find out that based on Shears there was no duty to warn. Or based on some rule about the code there was no warranty claim. In other words, if the plaintiff thought there was a good warranty claim, but on appeal it turns out, no, for a warranty claim there has to be some separate kind of damage, or for a failure to warn claim there has to be a duty, and after Shears there's not a duty. Then when it goes back on appeal, after that gets reversed, what they're asking you to do is reverse the punitive damages, even if the design defect claim would have been valid. If that's the case, The only way a plaintiff would be able to protect itself from that is to legitimately ask, I want a separate punitive damage fine on each underlying claim to guard against the risk of this happening on appeal. And they'd be entitled to. And that is going to be a nightmare for product liability. I don't think the state will be able to live with that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As I predicted in the beginning, there has been no defense to the duty of good faith and fair dealing in this case. $10 million in punitive damages for a net dispute between two parties in an arm's length contract disposition on that, with no defense of it whatsoever, although it was liberally argued to the jury, and for most of it was bashed up the head and shoulders because of it. And now they say it's totally immaterial, and this court is disempowered from reviewing it, and you must affirm it because, in chicken little fashion, the sky is going to fall because the trial courts in Texas can't figure out how to submit these punitive damages cases in any other way except for their own way. I must say to you that the due process clause, which has an implication to the award of punitive damages, simply does not stand in the face of such uncertainty. And all you must do is to look at your own decision in Wingate versus Heck to reverse this case. I do not wish to stand here and listen to the kind of things that I have heard about what is fraud in Texas. Fraud. You believe this? I want to go directly to Mr. Justice Heck's question about what happens when sign a contract which states specifically what the obligations are. And the rule is stated in the Fisher Controls case is that when experienced executives voluntarily sign a contract whose terms they know should not be allowed, to claim fraud in any earlier statement inconsistent with a specific contract provision. Otherwise, contracts would be nothing more than a scramble.
That's not what they're claiming, is it?
It's exactly what
they didn't say beforehand, well, we're going to mess up the schedule, but now we're going to say that you can have control of it. They didn't say that isn't what they're claiming.
That's exactly what they're claiming.
They're trying to say that they knew that they were going to mess it up, but they didn't.
No. What they are claiming in this case is that they implied certain things from the contract which were actually refuted by the contract. Isn't it amazing, Your Honor, how the word control has assumed the life of its own in this case in regard to the contract? Here is the representation in the bid package, which they will never read to. Contractor is responsible for FPC material management, including scheduling, receiving, quality checking, and storage. Where is the word control? And immediately following that statement says, contractor must follow FPC engineer instructions, project schedule, and priority. That's what we told them, and we also told them, after you let this contract, we will tell you what the procedure is. They learned what the procedure was 30 days into the job, and they performed the contract for 9 months after that, incurring all of these expenses, and that's fraud. And this business about we misrepresented and fraudulently stated that the job could be completed in 90 days. All that happened was on the bid sheet, it says this job is scheduled for 90 days. Scheduled for 90 days. And in the contract documents itself, we reserved specifically to the extent practicable, the sequence of commencement and completion of separable portions of the work shall be as owner shall direct. And they knew we had the right to keep them out of their work area from the very moment they got this bid package. And they performed the job for 9 months after they knew that, and they want fraud damages for that. And why do they say we are entitled for fraud damages for what is nothing more than a complaint for extra work incurred under this contract? Is because we got the jury to put in different numbers on the fraud fund, even though the measure that we advocate is a mythical contract which simply measures the performances of the parties due. And you cannot, in this case, base independent fraud damages upon a mythical contract for three reasons. Number one, the Airborne case says if your measure of damages is the value of the contract, that's contract damages and not fraud injury.
Mr. Anderson, this patent says it's scheduled for 90 days. Is that true?
It was scheduled for 90 days. That's correct, Your Honor.
I thought the argument was that as time Formosa said it, you can get back to 90 days, Formosa knew that that was not the schedule. That's what they represented.
Well, that's correct. That is their representation. And what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that they also knew.
That was the truth.
Oh, yes. What a true statement. It was scheduled for 90 days. And Mr. Burnett got the bid package. He independently computed each operation under the contract requirements, and he rejected the 90 days. And he wrote in 120 days. And then he encountered the delays that he sues for 30 days into the contract and performed in the face of them and stood to the bargain. And that is the problem, Justice Baker, with the mythical contract theory that they want to say is independent tort damages.
Are you answering Justice Enoch's question?
Pardon?
Are you answering Justice Enoch's question?
I put a comment there. If I could have the one finish this one sentence.
Well, if somebody has a question.
Would you finish your sentence?
Once you stand to the bargain, you must adhere to that bargain. You are not, after the bargain, entitled to manufacture independent tort damages, a mythical contract. Many cases hold that the benefit of the bargain damages in fraud cases is the bargain you strike.
But is it the bargain that they are being required to adhere to? But is it the bargain that they are being required to adhere to? Fraudulently obtained.
Not in any sense of the word. There are only three bases, Your Honor. One is materials, one is schedule, both of whom I demonstrated were not fraudulent representations. And the third is a supposed fraudulent promise to pay delay damages. And we paid delay damages. We paid them $600,000 under the contract. We offered them $256,000 in delay damages, which they rejected. And how in the world did you say in the face of that that we had no intention to pay delay damages? Your Honor must understand that this contract puts the risk of delay damages on the contractor. And in this case, the only way they could collect is if we were responsible for it under the contract. So anytime a claim was made, our responsibility and how much is it were the two issues. There was no representation that we would pay to the penny every contract claim they made for extras and delays. And yet that is their argument, because that's the only way they can make it into a fraudulent promise.
What does the contract say that we have the
contract? I didn't get the last.
What does the contract say?
The contract said precisely what I read a while ago, that insofar as FPC materials are concerned, we will tell you after this contract how they are to be ordered. They can be ordered as we authorize them to be ordered. And the contractor must follow all instructions of our engineering department. That's precisely what it says. And the only thing they are complaining about is the fact that we had a procedure that required them, even though they determined their own schedules, determined how much they needed, when they wanted it, that they could not pick up this telephone and call the contractor directly. And the reason for that procedure being implicated was because the contractor said, I cannot handle 300 contractors calling me. So Formosa simply used its contract right, which Presidio knew, to implement a procedure that says, we will call for you. to make a motion for disposition of the property. And I would suggest
any other questions?
$10 million.
Counsel, I think, counsel, I believe that you
have
the question.
Can you speak to Mr. Lynn's testimony that he knew and Formosa knew that their conduct was deceptive? Why wasn't that,
first of all, Your Honor,
buoy out of the water?
First of all, Your Honor, that again is one of those things that's being expanded. What Mr. Lynn was asked was a hypothetical question that if you sent a bid package that says a contractor is in control of materials, is that deceptive? And the quick answer to Your Honor's question is, we did not do that. And I just read a moment ago what the bid package said, and the word control is not in it, and the vesting of control, in fact, is clearly implied. The other answer to Your Honor's question is that any representations regarding control over concrete are simply nothing more than a supposed misrepresentation of fact. But misrepresentation of fact was not submitted as a ground of fraud in this case. So whatever Mr. Lynn says about it is totally different in this case. And thirdly, again, they knew of the concrete delivery schedule requirement 30 days into the contract, and their damages are based upon monies expended 90 days after that.
I have one more sure. question, please. If you're correct, and the punitive damage question was effectively submitted because the bad faith finding is there can be no recovery based upon the bad faith finding, what alternative do you have to offer to that proposed by Mr. Powers in order to avoid that problem in the future? Would indeed there have to be separate submission of a punitive damage issue for each alternative independent theory of recovery?
The solution is don't submit any theories that are not proper. That's the simple solution.
And to avoid that, you would have to submit them independently?
No. Don't submit any theories that are not proper. They knew that this was not a proper theory. Now, beyond that, how they're handled on an individual case, I can't say. Is not necessarily to be required in every case, particularly in instances where the conduct would be punished as measured may indeed be the same. In this case, of course, that's not true. We're looking at two different lengths of time. The simple answer, and the answer in this case, is don't submit the theory. Don't apply to the jury to get $10 million on the basis of it. If the judge has sustained our objection in this case and excised that independent, discrete theory, the charge would have been fine, the punitive damages would be saved. And I would suggest again, I suggested earlier, if you look at the Ralston Green case, you see exactly how that's handled.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument.